Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told with professional and volunteer ocean rescuers.
Whether lifeguards rushing into the waves from their towers, police and fireboats pulling victims from beyond the surf line, or bystanders taking action to save another, those who go down to the sea enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast and a new episode of They Had to Go Out Beach Rescue Series. So really appreciate you guys tuning in to our whole new series. And think that you're going to love what we got. Our first guest out of the gate, it just has an unbelievable story that I know everyone's going to learn a lot from and just truly be inspired by. So thanks for listening. You are not going to regret it.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. Glad you're here. If it's your first time listening, that's awesome. You picked, as usual, you picked a great one. We think they're all great ones, but this is a truly epic, dangerous, and daring story. After you listen to this and you like what you hear, go check us out on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook. Just type They Had to Go Out into your search engine and you'll find us. Give us a 5-star review on the podcast platform, whichever one you listen on. And tell us what you'd like to hear. If you've got a story you want to tell, reach out, let us know. We'd love to hear it.
And if you guys are wondering why this podcast in particular is coming out on a whole new series, right? So there's a new way to access this on all your podcast platforms. This one's called They Had to Go Out Beach Rescue. It's because we partnered with the Association for Rescue at Sea and kind of expanded our purview from just the Coast Guard to pretty much all ocean lifesavers. You haven't hit the Beach Rescue Edition. We also have the Distant Shores Edition, which is our international counterparts that are working oceans worldwide. So check out all three. And like Bill said, just search at They Had to Go Out, hashtag They Had to Go Out, or theyhadtogoout.com, and you will find all three shows, and you can listen on any of your favorite podcast platforms. So hey, with that said, let's get to the guests. Who we've got here? Mr. Jacob Walding, born in Cocoa Beach, Florida, in 2000, moved to the best coast out in Santa Cruz, California, and in 2006 started to work with the San Mateo County Harbor Master at Pillar Point. If you guys are unfamiliar with the area over there in NorCal, Pillar Point is where Mavericks is, which is the largest surf break in the continental United States. I've seen it personally, and more importantly, I've heard it. And let me tell you, these guys work in an incredibly dangerous environment and one that that should demand your respect. But with that, Bill, I'm going to let you ask the question that we will ask on all three podcasts of every guest to kick it off. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Jacob, what is your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
But the day in question, just to kind of lay it out, we were basically come on duty at 3 a.m., I work 3 to 1300. That's my shift at the harbor there.
Who decided on that shift? Those shift times. Is that a personal preference or what?
Yeah, it actually is a personal preference. I've worked all the shifts at the harbor. We're a county agency. We work 4-10s. It's kind of a unique place to work. They have kind of resisted doing the 24-hour coverage as far as a single team 24 hours through the night. And mostly just hung up on kind of ADA stuff. So the way to split the teams up the best or the guys up the best is we have a 3 to 1300. We have a 7 a.m. or 700 to 1700. And then we have a 1700 to 0300. Kind of gets guys home if they're coming on at night before it's light out. The day guys kind of get home and get to sleep, and the morning guys get home, still have the afternoon and can kind of get some sleep and feel somewhat normal, you know, getting up in the middle of the night. So that's kind of how that transpired over the years. But I like the shift. It's a good shift. And so on that day I was talking earlier and we were talking about kind of, we're a jack of all trades and a master of none. We have a lot of different guys with a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different skill sets. As you become a more senior officer, the real challenge is looking at your team that you have with you for the day and kind of playing things out in your head every day. You know, okay, well, if I get this type of scenario, I'll run it this way or that way. You know, a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, are enlisted Coast Guard or enlisted men and women. The interesting thing that's a little bit different about us is we work within the kind of the IC system, so the incident command system on the coast for San Mateo. So within that system, you have every agency that you could think of. You've got state parks, which is we have regular rangers, then we have wet rangers, which are lifeguards that are employed by state parks. We have fire, sheriff, CHP, and then the Coast Guard, and ourselves included in that system, obviously. So for this particular one, I had some fairly new employees on staff. I had two guys that had been there, both of them less than 4 months. One of them, Mr. Duffy, was a previous Coast Guard surfman as well. And he was there, and I was thankful and lucky for that. When the call comes in, it's basically 11:30 a.m., and we get the report over the sheriff radio. So we carry sheriff's radios, even though we're not sheriff's officers. We are deputy harbor master. And the call comes out, and the way that breaks down is it goes to sheriff. Sheriff puts it out to fire, state parks, everybody else. We'll request anybody that we think we need. So the call comes out. Hey, we've got a 911 call on a beach south of town, approximately 8 miles, and there's a woman in the water. The family can no longer see her. They're on the beach. They called it in. That's kind of the information we get. At that time, we go ahead and request, we have sheriffs are now rolling to that landside location. So they're going to get there and try to get eyes on. We, having that incident command system in place is really important for us because we have trust that we've built with these different agencies over the years. So for instance, whether the call comes through the fireside as a medical through 911 or goes as an emergency through sheriffs, and it can go either way. Sometimes they'll get routed CHP, then get kicked down to sheriffs. Sheriffs will kick. So, you know, there's just a plethora of ways that the stuff can come in. So,
which is a good thing, right?
Right. Yeah, it's great
because it gives people options for sure.
There's a lot of ways to get in touch with us. You know, yeah. You don't have to call our harbor line. You just call 911, and you're gonna get a full response from all agencies.
Hey, remember the most important one. What about VHF FM16? I know Pillar Point monitors that.
Yeah, you know we got
all right.
We,
all right, man.
That's my duty. So my duty.
Yeah, international hailing and distress.
Yeah. That's a big part of my job, and you guys got to keep reining me in here. We wear so many hats. So I, you know, my standard duty gear is a VHF radio, a sheriff radio, and a cell phone and a pager, and that's what I wear daily.
Tons of ways to get a hold of you there.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And you know,
I love that. What a government job, though. There's still a pager involved.
Right. For sure.
Yeah, and you know, and depending on how the call comes in, we end up being dispatchers first and foremost. So
right.
You know, we have to initially, if the call comes in, let's say it comes over the phone or VHF radio, I've got to take the appropriate information. You go down the SAR sheet. You guys are familiar with that, and you check all the boxes, and then you've got to start making the calls, you know, depending on, you know, hopefully you get a VHF call and the radio doesn't just cut out and you can get the information that you need off the SAR sheet and start passing it to other agencies, you know, and a lot of times that doesn't work. You get one call and it's, hey, I need help. I'm at the big golf ball on the hill, you know, and you're like, oh, okay, great. You know, and you start working it from there, but it really takes time in our job to kind of grasp it all and be able to really effectively manage that IC system. So we work as a dispatcher, and we will start. So on this particular call, SOs roll into the scene, fires rolling. This would be CAL FIRE. They're rolling to the location with a cliffside unit following them, and the chief is in his rig. And the chief would be set up as the IC command. So he's the guy that basically has the incident command structure. Everybody works under the fire chief in the incident command structure in San Mateo County. Mm-hmm. So they're going to the scene. We're trying to get more. We hear right away that there's a woman in the water. We know the conditions. We've trained in these areas. While I haven't trained at Cal's Beach in these particular conditions, I've trained at a lot of beaches up and down the coast. And I'll get into that further in the story.
Sure.
But so we start rolling up. So I'm lucky I've got.
Hey, Jacob, real quick, since we talked about, location, you mentioned the golf ball on the hill. I'm just going to test my local area knowledge. So how close is this to that really awesome Hawaiian place down there? Is it still there? Yeah, the Hawaiian place. There's like the Hawaiian restaurant that's down. It's just past, I think it's past Coder Point. You know what I'm talking about?
Ooh, I don't.
And, it must be gone. I'm gonna have to ask Mike Bushnell. I don't know. I thought I was there.
I don't know that it is anymore. It doesn't ring a bell. And I love my Hawaiian food.
Dude, so. You'd know it if it was there. Yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
I would. Mean,
it
would,
yeah. Yeah, this wouldn't
we've
even
got
be a
quite
question.
A few in Santa Cruz now. That's a different
yeah, do you? Nice. Yeah, good.
Four or five of them down here.
Yeah.
But anyhow, yeah. So, you know, you basically the guys are rolling to the sea, and we know they're going. We know it's a water rescue. So I send the old our new employee Brian with one of our very new guys. He'd been there maybe a matter of weeks at that point. And I had trained with Brian. We had just gone through a jet ski course, a K-38 course as a harbor, as all of our employees went through it together. So I got to start kind of building that team style relationship with him. And we rely on it so heavily. You really have to know. We get people that come in and they train with us and they go, we can't believe how close you guys are. You guys can, you know this, you serve with a bunch of guys for a while and you become family. I mean, there's no other way to put it. And we become very close, very quick. We spend a lot of time together, more so than with our families. And so I was just ecstatic to have him and be able to send him on our kind of our legendary Radden, which is just, you know, come out of the boatyard the year before, repowered, ready to go. So I sent him with our newer employee, Duke Bauer, and they went with Cal Fire on board as well. So part of that IC system is if we know we have a medical or potential medical, we have in the past bunch of years started taking the fire department on the boat with us, because then we have full tilt paramedics. While we have all the life-saving equipment on board the vessel, it gives us a chance to deploy with only two people on the boat, two patrolmen, and then take a full EMT crew, paramedic crew on the boat. It ends up being really advantageous for us. They can do their thing. If we ended up having to do some sort of hoisting evolution or something, we can focus on the hoist and getting the person in the body. They can do all of the medical side of it. So that said, they start rolling to the scene. We are trying to tighten up and do our dispatch side of life in the office before we go. Now, we are the game plan in kind of the pre-brief was you're going to take the Radden down with Station 41 on board, set up outside of the lineup. We might end up using you to vector in. The surf is going to be big down there. I figured it would be 15-plus foot, just knowing the day and kind of how the conditions had laid out.
Hey, Jacob, two things before we go into it, just since you're doing the pre-brief. So the Radden, you said she was legendary, right? Tell them what is the Radden. I mean, she got repowered, but what is she?
Okay, so the Radden is a Radden boat. So if you look up Radden Craft, Don Radden made his mark in the boat building industry back in the 60s and 70s in the Urchin and Abalone dive boat, kind of building specified boats. What Don came up with was a hull design that's very rounded in the front, nice hard chines in the back, kind of wide, very stout vessels. They surf very, very well on big swell. It was the first rescue vessel that Pillar Point Harbor purchased in the late 70s, and we've had it all along. We also have a secondary vessel, obviously. We have a 40-foot Almar. It's got twin Cummins in it, develops about 700 horsepower. Great boat, aluminum boat. You guys are familiar with aluminum boats. Ours on the private side of life or the private sector side of life tend to be a little bit lighter built. Mm-hmm. So it's a great boat, has a lot of really good advantages to it, but it is light and it, twin jet drives, doesn't really track the best, doesn't have a big keel. So the Radden has been around since the late 70s, just got out of the boatyard, redone, develops about 600 plus horsepower. It's gas, it's got IOs out the back. Partially enclosed cabin, and it's a great boat. It can handle big seas, and when I say big seas, I should quantify that. when I first got out to Pillar Point, a little side story with Mike Bushnell. I came out from Florida, and I've got to give this because it is a lot of your listeners will probably relate. When I grew up boating, you know, if there were breaking waves outside of you, you know, ocean side of you, you had made a series of bad choices. You know, you hadn't just made one.
For sure.
So when I got up to Pillar Point, the same held true, you know, and it took me a while to get used to. You leave the harbor, and if you're not familiar with it, you leave the harbor and you're inside of a reef, and you travel about a mile south, and then there's an entrance or a channel that you can cut out through and get out to open water. And so one of the first times Mike took me out is he got me hired. I get up there and I'm like, man, I gotta be honest with you, Mike, I'm still uncomfortable out here. How long does it take? You know? And he's like, you'll get used to it. Let's go. We're going to start training. And so he's kind of putting me through the paces, and we go out, and it's a day, and it's gotta be, you know, the swell's like 18 foot at 20 plus seconds, you know, we're out and there's like 20.
Mike Bushnell, dude. Mike Bushnell. That sounds like a Mike Bushnell day.
And you got to get him on here. The guy's legendary. And he takes me out, and there's, you know, it's every bit of 30-foot faces kind of coming through the channel. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, we're going to go out and go back. Okay, I'm good with going out. And he's like, yeah, check this out. You know, he goes, he turns the boat around. And he's like, the best thing about this vessel is how it surfs. And I'm like, surfs? You know, lifetime surfer. I'm like, well, I don't surf boats, you know. And he's like, no, trust me. And he takes off, you know, gives it some throttle and gets on the face of one and proceeds to carve the boat on the face of this every bit steep 45-foot face. And I'm literally, this is so funny, I plaster myself between the window and I grab one of the handholds on the boat, the rails, and he looks at me and he just starts laughing. And my
eyes
with saucers. And he runs through the pass and he goes, don't worry, it'll get easier. You know, we're going to keep doing this till you're comfortable. And I'll never forget that story. And I know he remembers it because it was probably as scared as he's ever seen a grown man in his life. But awesome. So to quantify the story big, you know, we know big, we're used to big. We go out, you know, Mavericks, we've had days where it's 80 foot, you know, I mean, and you get really accustomed to it very quickly. A couple years, and you're very used to being out in big stuff. You're used to how the boats handle and how to kind of read waves and know what they're kind of doing. So all that to bring that back to this story of this day is I send Duffy out, and I know he's a surfman. I know he's got the experience to get outside the surf line and hold that vessel as close as he can without being in danger and putting anybody in harm's way. So he goes, and we proceed to do our dispatch thing and call the Coast Guard, make sure they're rolling, make sure State Parks is heading that way with their wet rangers to get on the beach and get us any assistance if we have to get somebody to the beach or a body potentially to the beach. And then we suit up, and we've been utilizing the RWCs, in layman's terms, jet skis, like I mentioned earlier, from about 2003 on.
And is everybody going through K-38 classes to run those? Is that like the preferred training venue?
I don't like to say preferred. You know how that stuff goes.
Yeah, I got you. I'm sorry. Yeah, good point.
Yes, we all go through K-38. The program that Sean has put together is a great program. It brings people up and into a very good teachable standard pretty quick. We do a lot of kind of intense in-house training. You really have to. There's no training that's going to supplement time, and so you just have to understand surf. You need to be a surfer, and you need to, or not a surfer, you need to be a wave rider of some sort to really use those things effectively, really be comfortable body surfing and kind of knowing how waves work and what the limitations of the machine are. And so
I love how you were comfortable, like you were talking about getting comfortable with the wave height and stuff, right? The wave height's one thing, man. You know what kills me is the sound. Dude, like at Mavericks, just the sound is, I don't know, we're further south than Mavericks for your story, but just that sound alone would like deter, you know, 90% of people from ever even like leaving the shore to stare at it, right?
Yeah, it's unreal. And, you know, it's really a unique beast in that you can be so close to it. I remember the first time I was out there and, you know, I'm just looking at these mountains of water and I'm looking at the, you know, the calm on the senior patrolman's face at the time. You know, I got hired on and had all these great guys, these big Alaskan king crab fishermen, and, you know, these guys that had just seen some gnarly stuff in their life, and they're out there calm and they're joking around, and you know, and I'm inside trying to be cool, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, like, I don't even know if I can swim out of here. You know,
plastered,
like,
to the wall.
Yeah,
right.
Trying not holding to on. That, you know, like, just so green and going, yeah. my Lord, like, how can I swim back to the channel if the boat gets turtled? Like, what is going on, you know? And, but you do get used to it yeah. pretty quick, you know, and it's amazing. But yeah, K-38, great class. We do a lot of training. So we've kind of, for the listeners, so with the RWC program, or the jet ski program, I'll say in layman's terms just so we keep everybody on the same page, we have limited comms. So they're great machines. They're fast. They're very dynamic. They are super maneuverable. But once we're on them, we really only have a VHF radio. We'll carry our phones and what would be like the glove box of the machine. But your hands are wet, even in a LifeProof case, they're not super effective to really do any type of communication. So we carry a radio. It monitors two channels, just set a primary and a secondary. So my partner of the day, Bobby Dunn, great guy. I've worked with him for about 4 years at this point, maybe five. I'd have to look back. He had been on a few other cases with me on the RWCs, and we had developed that kind of tight bond. I had seen him saw him in a pretty bad spot at one point, and he kept his cool. And so I was just beyond stoked to have him as the wingman on this one. And so he took 21 as his secondary channel and 16 as his primary. So he's going to be able to talk to any incoming Coast Guard assets. And then he's going to be, depending on how quick he can get to his mic, he can talk with the helo. We're figuring that everybody's coming on this particular one. So I'm on channel 7-4, which is our harbor working frequency, and channel 16. And what that does is, while we work in a bubble when we're on the jet skis, we are still within eye shot of each other. So we try to stay, you know, a safe distance from each other, you know, 25 feet or so, you know, 50 feet. Try to stay as a pair in case something happens to a machine, mechanical issue, so on and so forth. Try to keep eyes on, right? Comm systems aren't 100%. So I'm on 7-4 as a primary, 16 as a secondary. He's on 16 as a primary, 21 as a secondary. And so you got to work all these things out, because once you get later into the call, they're in a pack that is sewn into our PFD, or our life jackets, on our backs. They're waterproof. Once they're zipped up, you're pretty much there. If you mess up the volume and you don't get the volume right, it's going to either blow your ear out, or you're not going to be able to hear. You're going to have to come off the RPM on the machine to hear comms. So we suit up, get all our ducks in a row, and I mentioned to him in the chase as we're walking out the door, I said, listen, you're excited, I'm excited. Let's just remember, you know, dot our I's, cross our T's. You know, our response is only as good as we are before we leave here. So we finish all our calls in the office, and then we step out of the office, and now we're part of the IC system. We're now a finger in the hand. We're two guys on jet skis responding and going to do the best we can. So where do you guys
fit, Jacob, in the IC structure? So you got the IC as the fire chief, right? And then, yep, or fire captain. And then it comes down to, are you guys a task force? Or how does that work?
So basically, I explain it in layman's terms to people, is the incident command, the incident commander is the hand, and everybody else is a finger on that hand. And we all work laterally. Nobody has really, once we're in that system, there's authorities, but we work close together. So if it's, we kind of all have to know everybody's responsibility, but it's all loose. So if it's some sort of something that would be handled by the sheriff normally, but now it's just in the water, what we're going to do is try to get somebody to land or get sheriff to them so that they can do their job. So there's a structure, but there's not a hierarchy that you're probably, or your listeners are probably used to, as far as fire command, sheriff, you know, Pillar Point Harbor Patrol, state parks, you know, everybody has their jobs that they excel at, and everybody in this system, in this county, knows the who's who in the zoo, so to speak.
Right. Cool.
So, Jacob, we go ahead.
Real quick before we move on, I was going to ask you, so how long from the time you get that call until you're heading out the door to get on the jet ski and go out there, like how long is that? Does that take for you, you know, to kind of do all that, get your dispatch done, get your information, that kind of stuff?
So 6 minutes, roughly.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's pretty fast. You know,
it's a pretty solid answer.
We try to be out the office in 6 minutes. You know, there's no set time. You know, you do what you have to do, and you answer as many calls as you can, because it ultimately makes your job, it makes you more effective long term to get as much information out there as you can before you dispatch, and then you're limited comms. And with the mics on the RWCs, and us, we'll be on the point a lot of times in these things, because what you'll see further in the story is how it really starts to transpire. But I, in my head, try to be out the door in 6 minutes. There's no set time. You know, there's been times where it's been, you know, the calls coming in, it's, we're getting mixed messages. We're not even sure where to respond yet. But all of that kind of happens very fast. And that's one of the things that really takes time in this job to kind of get dialed in, is knowing who's who to call and when to call and when to wait, and you know, so on and so forth.
And do you guys do a risk assessment? Because that's, I mean, that's the new buzzword, right? Is risk assessment for everyone. So what, I mean, is there anything like that there? I know in your head, right? I'm sure that goes through everyone's head, but formally, like, is there a program?
So the politically correct answer is yes, of course.
We'll go with yes. Okay.
I just heard 18 in the green. That's what I just heard.
I heard 6 minutes, dude. That's what I heard. I like it. Six minute
risk assessment for sure. You know, what we do is, you know, all joking, or, well, let's throw another joke out there. I've told a lot of the new staff that come on board, you know, listen, you're going to get a chance in your career to do some very dynamic type work. And our number one goal is to not ever make anything worse. So you have to keep that in the back of your mind. And if you keep that in the back of your mind and you work within the guidelines, and that's really the beauty of our job, is we have guidelines. We don't have black and white. We don't have, if it's this big, you can't go. If it's, you know, this shallow, you can't go. If it's in this restricted area or on a chart, you can't go. We're allowed to make those determinations. And that's really ultimately what saves lives and what makes us very effective. So all of that said, you know, if you're a senior guy and you've been at the harbor for, you know, 8, 9, 10, 12, 14 years, you've seen so many calls and seen, you've seen the good and the bad and the ugly, and our post-rescue debrief ends up being huge, because we get together, we're a bunch of brothers, there's no formal debrief, it's, we sit down, and it's, you would think we had been living together for 20 years right out of college. I mean, it's ruthless and, you know, cutthroat, and guys, and there's no egos, and we remind guys, hey, listen, there's no egos, we're going to get better, we're going to come out of this, and we're going to be so much of a stronger team. And some of the new guys come in and they go, oh my God, that was, you know, intense, or that was, you know, this and that. And I was like, look, we're a team, we're a family, you know, this is what we do, and we do it effectively, and we're going to continue to do it effectively. And that's how it goes. So the short answer is yes, we debrief, or we,
solid answer. Yeah, for sure. We got it.
So anyhow, so we get down to the RWCs. My partner's out of the door ahead of me. He's got mine uncovered, ready to go. He's in the water. I launch mine off our floating dock, and I'm behind him. We know we're going to Cowles. We've got basically a 6.5 mile run south. Conditions are rough. We just got the Kawasaki's. We had trained on them, but I had not run a rescue call on them. I had not run at speed in big swell and sea states on them. So we get on them, and, you know, again, I'm like, all right, let's go. The Radden has left 6 minutes prior, so they've got a pretty good lead on us. And we go out, and we're going to try to arrive at the scene about the same time as them. So we come out of the harbor, we pick our bearing south, and we start kind of heading down. We've got 3 to 5 foot wind waves that day. So we've got, for most of you guys obviously understand this, most of your listeners, but 3 to 5 foot wind waves are waves that are wind-driven that are on top of ground swell. And for that ground swell of the day, we had west swell 10 to 12 foot at 18 seconds. And that 18-second period was, it's pretty intensified in on our beaches. You know, you guys know that from your years of service, and all your listeners do. So we're running down there. I'm sorry, I'm looking at my report right here. It says the sea state was 4 to 5 foot. So we're running down there, and when you're running on these things, you're an independent operator operating in a bubble. So you're running kind of abreast of your guy that you're running with. I'm letting my partner take the lead. I want him to lead because I want him to only ride as comfortable as he is without chasing me. So I'm letting him kind of be about 150, 200 feet in front of me, and I'm kind of watching the action of his machine while, you know, kind of negotiating these waves on top of waves. And we were able to maintain about 22 to 25 miles per hour speed over ground on the way down there, which is pretty fast. I mean, that's
moving with just the five
footers.
Dude.
Yeah.
My lower back hurts from the story already.
And that's a thought about my partner.
Save some lives,
you know?
Bro. That's what that is. That's a desire to save some lives. I like it.
Yeah, and that says a lot about my partner, who's on the other RWC with me, Robert Dunn. He came into the program just a few years ago, or came on our team, and he's really taken it and run with it and become so proficient. And it really is a testament to his ability. And as you'll see further, you know, we leave that team that I keep talking about. You know, I have to rely on him heavily later in the rescue. So we're rolling down there, and I'm not getting any comms. You know, basically the radio's quiet. We're cruising. It's a pretty good run, about 14 minutes or so, which seems, you know, when you add on, you're doing the calculations in your head, as you guys know, you're going, wow, man, the call went out. She was, whoever this was probably in the water for several minutes before the call went out. You know, you're going, God, a half hour in the water, you know, and these are all just the things that all the guys that are listeners here have put these things through their head in one form or another, you know, and you're starting to, you know, you're just doing your thing. You're doing the best you can for this potential victim. So we're getting down there. We're about an eighth mile away, and my radio goes off, and so I slow my RPMs down, and I come back, and I'm on channel 7-4, which I explained earlier. And what we have had great success with is our battalion chief, Ari DeLay. I'll give him a shout out. Great guy. I've worked with him for, at this point, 14 years. He had started and implemented kind of carrying a VHF radio in his rig to talk directly to our RWCs, knowing just from the years we've trained together that one of us will always have 7-4 on. So it's an instant information highway right to us. He can give us updates and whatever. So he comes up and he goes, you know, Pillar Point RWC, you guys got me there. I come back, you know, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Chief. And he says, hey, man, I see the Radins on scene. He goes, she's still on the surface. She's still moving her arms a little bit. And I'm like, okay, I'm about an eighth mile out to your northwest. So he goes, okay. So we take off. We keep running. I tell my partner before we take off, I said, hey, man, she's still on the surface. She seems to be moving a little bit. So we keep going toward the Radin. At this point, the Radin craft is now set up in the lineup. We can see the fire engines on the hillside. The bluffs are about 8,700 foot right in that area. Stairs down to the beach. So we know where we're going. So we run to the location right outside of the surf line, inside of where the Radin is. We kind of do a scene survey, you know, is kind of what we're all taught to do. And I'm not surprised at what I see, but I'm, you know, like, okay, you know, here it is. Now it's real. We've got big waves, 15, 20 foot faces pushing through, and frankly, you know, time goes so slow in these seconds. You know, you just
absolutely.
You're just sitting there and you're looking at the situation, and you know, it's amazing. You know, when I remember thinking, I can't believe she's still on the surface. I can't believe that's even a possibility. You know, at this point, and my radio goes off again. It's Ari, and as you guys know, or a lot of your listeners that have been in really big swell. When you're in the trough of these swells or in between waves, you can't see anything. We couldn't see the cliff ahead of us. It's 100 foot. We couldn't see anything behind us. You know, you're in the trough and it's almost surreal. You know, there's no wind. It's calm, you know, and you're just like looking around at these mountains of water, you know, and my radio goes off and it's the chief again, Ari. And he goes, Jacob, he goes, she's still on the surface. And I go, okay. I go, where is she? And he goes, you just have to come right at my fire engine, aim right for my fire engine. And I said, is she in line with the Radin? And he goes, yes, between my engine and the Radin offshore, she's right in line. And I go, okay. So I tell him, listen, I'm not going to be able to see her until she either pops out of a wave or you're going to have to guide me right into her. I can't see her. The waves are too big. And he goes, okay, I'll give it to you in a count. So I kind of line up. I use the Radin to kind of vector it in. We line up. I brief my partner. I say, here's the deal. We're going to go in. We're going to make a pass. Apparently, she's still on the surface. I'm going to try to grab her. If she's closer to you, we'll make that on the fly. You'll try to grab her, and I'll work back up for you. He says, okay. And
we've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
Start to make our approach. There's a large swell approaching from the west, and we start to make our approach. It's a big one, you know, and we're in it. We're in the trough, you know. And as it sucks up, there's a reef that we know we're on, but I had never personally seen it break because I, you know, when you're training, you can't realistically, you wouldn't go into these situations because, you know, it's just, there's the risk versus reward of training in a scenario like this is just not there. So we start to make our approach and this wave sucks up behind us. And it's the second wave, I believe, of the set. We had one in front of us. Well, it sucks up and there's dry reef. And my partner, I look over at him, and he has to fade off the top. There's basically brown kelp rocks in front of him. And so he starts to loop back to the right and kind of, or to starboard and kind of over. He's going to go over the shoulder and get on the back of it and then ride it through. And I'm in a spot where I've got a lot more rock kind of on either side of me, and I'm in a little channel. So I can see some sudsy-looking water in front of me, and I'm like, all right, you know, the bottoms of the hulls are slick. Let's get some RPM, and, you know, if we hit a rock, we're going to skip across it, and hopefully we get to the other side, and we can pull ourselves together.
I don't, you know, hey, for anybody that's listening, like, if you don't understand what Jacob just said, I mean, you're looking at these waves are pulling water and exposing a reef, and one of these guys to save a life is going to wait until the wave, like, breaks and goes over this reef and ride it in, right? I mean, that's... Dude, what a tail, man!
So that's very close. What I actually did is there's a hump of rocks on my right and on my left, and what I could see was there was foamy aerated water between them, and so I wasn't going to let the wave pass. I wanted to stay in front of it because it's so big. If it catches me, I'm going to get yard sailed. I'm going to get basically strewn across, you know, and then I got to swim, and you know, probably not going to be able to get back to my machine, and then I've made the situation worse. So. I shoot the gap, and within a second, I make it through, and I'm like, whew, all right. We're in it, you know?
Now, hey, oh, that worked.
Good reaction, dude. Good reaction. You know,
and we get, right away, my radio goes off. Hey, she's 175 feet in front of you. Keep coming at me. And I'm like, I don't have time to grab my mic and talk. It's a push-to-talk kind of mic system that we have in our helmets. So I just keep on with my speed, about 20 knots. I got to stay within that trough. He goes, you know, my mic comes back up, 150 feet, 125 feet, 100 foot, 75 foot, 50 foot. You should be able to see her. She's right in front of you. And I glance up, look back at the waves behind me. I glance up, and I see what looks like a kelp ball in the aerated water. And, you know... We're lucky that the seconds slow down. I don't know if your viewers many of them have been in this situation where you think that in these times you're not going to have a lot of time to make decisions, but the body is very adapt. It's slowing things down to a spot where you can make very critical decisions in some of the most crazy short amounts of time. And you just think when you're training, you know, you're like, how do you think about all that at the time? And I'm telling you, man, I had this full internal dialogue as I'm approaching her, you know, I'm doing 20 knots at her. I'm closing the distance really quick, but in my mind, it's very, very slow. And I'll explain that as best I can to the viewers. As I'm looking at what looks like a ball of kelp to me, I can tell that her hair is in her face. She can't wipe the hair out of her face at this point. So I've already determined that if she can't wipe the hair from her face, knowing that when people are at that point of complete exhaustion, they're basically done. They have done what they can. I don't even think she can see me. I don't think she knows I'm coming. And so initially, when I'm outside of the surf line, my goal before this starts is if I can get in and I can get her hand with my off-throttle hand, I have a rescue board behind my machine. So it's like a sled that we tow behind. And if I can just get her wrist, I can use the RPM of the machine to kind of sling her up behind me as I roll my shoulder back and put her on that board. And then we can get out to the shoulder, and then I can package her and get her out of the lineup, and we can get her back out to the boat or whatever we need to do. So as I'm coming in, I see just her head. I don't see her arms waving. I don't see anything, and she's slipping back below the water. And I'm closing the distance, and in my head, I think again, okay, I can try to hair grab her. It's pretty crude, but I've had success with it in the past. And then she goes under the water, and I'm like, oh, God, you know, like, there's no chance that I'm going to see her again if this set of waves that's behind me is allowed to mow over top of her. So we were faced with a couple decisions, you know, do I ride out of it and, you know, turn around and try to find her? Maybe she comes back to the surface. I don't have that in my DNA. I'm wearing a new type of PFD life jacket that we had just gone to, and I hadn't had time to surf train with it. It had 15 pounds of buoyancy in it. My concern was as she slipped under, I go, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to swim down. Even if I jump off the machine, I'm not going to be able to actually swim down. I don't have my fins are on my fin belt. A lot of good they do me on my fin belt. You know, I can't see her hair, but I'm coming up on her fast enough that I've closed the distance. I'm almost on top of her. And so the only thing I can think is I'm going to go by her on the machine, and I'm going to do a kind of a cartwheel. So I'm going to basically, she's on my port side. So I'm going to stand heavy on my left foot. My right foot went on the seat. And what I did is basically threw myself into what would be a reverse dive. And I basically, my thought process was I need to penetrate the water. I need to get chest to chest with her as quick as possible. So I'm going to try to basically do kind of like a cartwheel on top of her, basically, in essence, and land in kind of a diving head down, feet above my head position to drive myself so I can get my chest on her back. So it worked. I come in, I do this cartwheel off my machine. I don't even know where it goes. It ghost rides for a few seconds. And I land on her, and I grab hold of her, and I pull her in, and I pop her up, and we're facing west. So we're facing out to sea, and I look up, and I see this whitewash coming at me, and I'm like, okay, you know, I've got to hold her tight. She can't do much. I don't even know if she's conscious at the point, but I took my left leg, and I wrapped it around her body and across her midsection, across her belly, and I locked what would be like a figure four lock with my right leg. So now she's there. Then I took my right leg and I weaved it down behind her right leg, behind the knee. And so that gives me an effective body lock. It's a technique that I used 10 years prior to this on another call where I had to get some kids out of some pretty big surf. And then I come with what we call a seatbelt grip. So it's my left arm under her armpit, my right arm over her shoulder, over her right shoulder. And then I lock my hands in front of her. The arm that is under her armpit goes to my elbow, and then that leaves my free hand to cover her mouth, pinch her nose and cover her mouth. So I look up. I've got a few seconds till this wave comes. I get her in the hold, and I said, my name's Jacob Walding. I'm going to save you. We're going to get out of this together. I'm going to have to cover your mouth. It's so you don't drown. And she doesn't
answer. Dude, I believe you. Right. Just when, you know, like, right when you said, I believe it. That was awesome, man. Yeah, good.
It's funny. You just revert back to that lowest level of training. It's something that I was trained, you know, years ago. Is, you know, you got to let people know that you're in command of the situation. You guys know this, and that they're getting out of here. And, you know, you don't want somebody, you know, she looks lethargic. I grab her, she's lethargic, but you never know. Like, somebody can last, like, bout of I'm going to die, and they freak out. And, you know, you just want to take everything out of the equation that you can so that you can affect change. So I wait for the wave. I cover my mouth. Wham. I go under. We get rolled upside down a bunch. And, you know, and then I'm happy that I have the 15-pound flotation because I don't have to swim. I literally just have to hold on to her and calm my heart and say, all right, man, we're going to come back to the surface. We might come feet first. God knows which way we're coming up, but we're going to get back. And I pop up and, you know, I orientate myself to the west, and here comes another one, and we take that one on the head, and I'm letting her breathe in the middle. I should back up, I guess. When we pop up, I uncover her mouth, and I said, I need you to breathe. And I can see that her eyes are open, but she's not there. She's not home. You know what I mean? It's like when you look at somebody and you're just like, wow, this is crazy. You know, I've never seen somebody so gray in the skin. That was what really shocked me in this one, and had them still be alive. All I can attribute it to, and you know, maybe somebody can fact check this, one of your followers, but maybe she had just used literally all the oxygen she had to kind of survive to this point. But she was gray, like what we find when we find somebody that's deceased or we do a recovery. Mm-hmm. And so I tell her, listen, take some breaths if you can. We're going to do the same thing again, you know, and I cover her mouth and we take another one on the head. My partner was on the backside, so he sees me. I must note this. We'll step back one more time. Sorry about this, guys. He had looped over the back of the wave that I was in front of. He's now coming through, and to really give him credit where credit is due, when he looped around that wave, he used the vector on the Radden, which was the boat that was offshore, and the Fire to get back in line with the same trajectory that he was taking into the surf line. Not knowing what was going to happen to me or what I was going to do, he didn't want to run me over if something bad had happened and I had come off my machine. He doesn't want me to pop up out of the back of a wave and he hits me at 20 miles an hour and makes a thing. So it was really just kind of one of those mission critical type details where he had the wherewithal to, even in the stress of the situation, to take a cool head and be like, I got to get back on my line. I've got to take that same course setting in to keep everybody safe. So We pop up, I tell her, hey, we got to do this again. We're going to go under another one. And I don't remember seeing him go by. He said he went by me at like 20 foot away. You know, if you guys have worn comm sets in the water, you know, you get water in your ears, it gets trapped in there. All of a sudden, your equilibrium's a little bit messed up. So I'm kind of like grabbing my helmet, shaking my ears, you know, and I cover her mouth again. And we take another wave on the head. And then I pop up. And I let her breathe, and I'm like, all right, I'm facing west. There's no more waves for the second. And now I'm like, okay. So now I unlock the body lock, and I start swimming toward the beach. And my partner, he's looped over. He comes over a wave. He comes up to my side, to my starboard side, grabs my kind of my PFD on the neck, and he goes, I got you. Let's get her on. And he has a rescue board as well. So I'm like, all right, it kind of swings me in an awkward shape because he grabs my PFD with his left hand behind the neck, which puts my left shoulder to the board, which is actually ideal, but I've got her with my left hand. So I couldn't let her go under the arm because I've unlocked the body lock anyhow. So I struggle to get her on the board, and I can't compress the board. I'm pretty gassed at this point. I've got my knee on the board trying to sink it the way that we kind of trained to do and get her up there. But she's so lifeless, as you guys know, you know, wet sack of potatoes. They're hard to manhandle in the water, all while looking around and going, oh, my God, here comes another swell, you know. And he's looking at me and he's like, come on, man, you got her. And he's I'm trying to load her up. And I'm like, I'm doing my best, you know. And I get her halfway on the board and he's like, I have to go. And I'm like, all right, let's try it, you know. And he goes, and I don't have her all the way on the board. I couldn't get her all the way up there. I had my knee between her legs on the board, and I had my left hand on the board, my right hand on the board. But she starts to slide off the board as he starts to put the RPM to it. And I end up, she rolls back across me. I grab her tight and try to hang onto the board to get drug as far from that breaking wave as possible. And then I end up falling off, and I'm like, okay, here we go. Let's lock her back up. So I put the body lock back on her, do all the things I said before, and we take another wave on the head. Luckily, that wave was breaking, and he was able, by me hanging on with my left arm, he was able to drag us closer to the shoulder. So we only had to take one on the head, which was great for me. I was
for sure. Yeah.
So basically, at that point, he comes back around, loops around. And he comes up to me and he's like, let's get her on this time. And I'm like, hey, man, I want to side saddle her. Just let's get her over the seat. So he grabs her hands and he goes, you know, we're going to throw her over the seat in front of him on the RWC. She's going to lay belly down with her head in the footwell. And he's then going to take his knee and put it in the small of her back. And then I'll climb on the rescue board and we'll deal with it when we get her to the beach. At this point, the swell's so big, we don't want to try to take her out through. So that's what we do. We throw her over the seat. He puts his knee in. I climb up on the board, and he's like, all right, you know, let's go. And he positions our machine. He loops back. We go over the top of one from the shoulder, and then we're following it in, and we're on the back of the wave. And so our protocol for this type of a beach entry is, you know, you've got very steep beaches. We've got 4 to 12 foot waves breaking on the sand. It's a very.
And you mean on the sand, dude?
Right. Yeah,
down true there, short when he says break on the sand, it is breaking on the sand. Yeah, these are like very dangerous waves.
Yeah, I don't mean, and there's some pictures. I don't know if you guys have seen them, but they're around of us after the rescue with one of the machines. And it's literally breaking on the sand. And the beach is 40 degree angle, roughly, soft, aerated sand. You know, you sink halfway up your shin every step, like quicksand, basically.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I'm like, stay on, I yell at him, stay on the back of this one. We got to get as high as we can up that beach, you know, knowing that we're going to get hit by other waves in the swell. That's just the way it's going to go. So he gets and he's running right on the back of it, and it kind of lobs out on the beach. And if you time it right, it's beautiful. The wave hits it, its energy is kind of dissipated into the sand, and your RWC will kind of go up and beach right there in the water. As it pulls back, you're high and dry. And he executed perfectly. He literally kept us right at the right speed to get us as high up the beach as we could. And then we scrambled, as soon as we hit the beach, it's okay, now we got to get her off, because if there's a bigger one coming, that machine is, they're heavy machines, 1200 pounds, and they'll kill you as quick as anything else in that environment.
Right. It went from being an asset to a liability real quick at that point.
Exactly. And now we've got a victim that's side saddled over the machine. And we've got to basically drag her off. So we grab her and we drag her off the machine, and basically he grabs her arms and I grab her feet, and we just start running as fast as you can up that degree of a beach to an awaiting fire crew. And we passed her off to them, and that was kind of where it ended for our side of things. She was transported in critical condition, critical but stable condition. She apparently was conscious the entire time, which is hard for me to even believe. I've never had a chance to talk to her directly. She was transported to the hospital. She stayed for a few days for secondary drowning. You guys are familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. That was the end of the rescue. And I remember standing there with my partner. I gave him a hug, and I said, God, man, it was awesome. I go, you did everything you were supposed to do, everything we've trained for, and it worked out. We don't know what's going to happen with her, but you couldn't have done better in my perspective. And he said, man, I can't believe you were in the water. He goes, he's like, I was on the back of the wave, and all of a sudden, there's your helmet. It just pops up. He's like, I'm thinking, oh, my God, what happened? And then I see you got her in your arms, and so it was one of those the definite team-building moments with your brothers that you serve with.
Sure.
It was interesting. We tried to get one of the machines off the beach. My machine was completely totaled. I was going to ask,
it's not really the important part of the story, but I wondered what happened.
Yeah. So these were brand new machines. I mean, I don't even know that they had been on a rescue, both of them Kawasaki's. We had just gone to Kawasaki's from Hondas. We had Hondas for years. They were a lot lighter. My machine never touched a rock, but it was tumbled in that, 4 to 12 foot surf on sand, and the helm was snapped off. The hull was still intact. Props to Kawasaki for making a tough machine.
Wow.
His machine had taken a beating in the time that we had got basically the patient up to the higher level of care, the firefighters on the beach. And, we basically did a risk assessment on it, is it even worth trying to get it out of here today or just leave it? So we borrowed some stuff from the fire department, some cliff rescue stuff, and borrowed some labor from them as well. They sent down all their boys, and we drug those things up the beach as high as we could, staked them off well above the high tide line, and left them. Went back the next day and recovered them with cranes. But, really all in all, it's a testament to the incident command system, and really how a county becomes a family. We're all first responders. We all have our jobs, and we all rely on each other so much, in all these different situations. And you take that and apply that all over the country. It's really a testament to how the system works. And, without anybody in that system, it could have been different. I mean, the backstory on it that I found out after the fact was, her children, her husband, and her parents were all on the beach that day. She had gone into the water because her dog got swept off the beach to save her dog. And we all know how that goes. Your dogs will self-save. The dog got out, 20 minutes after she had gone into the water and was fine. And it was, it's nice sometimes you get these types of rescues, and it kind of feels like it's a balance in the universe. You know, we deal with so many recoveries and so many where they don't turn out, and we always, you know, you're only human if you don't think about it, and you know, you go, God, we didn't save that one today, or there was nothing we could have done. You know, you did the best you could, and you acted how you were trained to act. But everybody has that internal dialogue with, man, was there anything else? Could we have gotten better? Could we have done better? You know, and this was one of those kind of bright star moments where, you know, and I've thought about this one a lot. I try not, you know, to think about them too much, you know, just try to debrief it and kind of moving on, you know, got a long career ahead of me still. But this one was unique that I have kids similar to his kids' ages. And I remember, you know, the days after, you know, thinking about what it would be like to be a father and be on the phone and trying to call for help and having your kids there and trying to get them away from the water so that they don't see their mom ultimately perish. And that struggle as a parent, and that hit home with me, you know, it was it was something that I still think about quite a bit, about how just the selflessness of that, watching, you know, the dynamic of having your kids there and trying to be, you know, be a great father. You know, that guy's like father of the year, you know.
Yeah, for sure, so, man. He's lucky Polo Point Harbor Master was there to help her out, bro.
For sure.
I'll tell you what, man, like, listening to the story, all I can think was at Station Golden Gate, right, at the Coast Guard Station, that's where I was for like 7 years. And I always remember, if we got a call south of Pillar Point, it was like, well, screw it, man. Those guys got it. Yeah, without fail. We would try to beat you every single time. Never made it. I mean, obviously you guys are closer, but just you guys had it every time. And there was never a question about
how, we don't get out the door in 6 minutes either, Phil.
No, dude. And these guys are true. I mean, Pillar Point, man, true pros. Like, you guys right. have the
Sounds
equipment.
Like it, for
you
sure.
You got the training. And then you've got the attitude, right? I think the attitude's the key, and you just kind of clue people into that organizational attitude you guys have down right. there of,
well,
hey,
it sounds
we are
like
pros and we're going to save.
Super professional, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, Jacob, you were talking about, you know, you said time slows down for you, but I think that's a testament to the training you guys get. Because I know when I've been in any kind of emergency situation in our job, you're not really doing it. You think you're doing all that thinking, but you're really not. You're a lot of times you're just falling back on, okay, when this happens, this is what I do. When this happens, this is what I do. And it's so just like ingrained inside you.
Yeah. And I agree with that 100%. I think I'm lucky, you know, it's a great job. And for your listeners out there that are getting up there in age, you know, find a harbor, you know, find a place like Pillar Point, come work with us. You know, we love it. And, you know, when you guys decide that you're done, some of your listeners with maybe their service life, you know, there's more out there. You know, you can make change and put all that training that you've gained over the years to work and continue to save people, you know. And it's really a great organization that I work for. And, you know, we are governed by a board of commissioners. And they have never once, that I'm aware of, ever cut funding to any type of training, to any type of patrolman, anything associated with the patrolman. They see us as boots on the ground, and we're the reason they're there. And that's really a testament to the commission and the way that they handle themselves and kind of their mission statement. And, you know, and then we've got a new general manager. He was a Coast Guardman for quite a bunch of years. Mr. James Pruitt, and he had just started, and he came down and talked with me, and, you know, had a good talk. And, you know, it was nice to see right away. He stepped right in, and he wasn't unfamiliar with this. He was unfamiliar with the jet ski portion of it.
Sure.
As he's like, well, I managed rescue swimmers for years, and, you know, this is pretty crazy, this particular instance, you know. And he wanted to talk about it, and, you know, but he's like, hey, listen, you know, I don't care if you go out and demo a machine every time you go out, if you're saving lives and that's the goal. He's like, I support you. And it was just great to hear, you know. And
yeah, for sure.
You know, the other thing is staying fit. You know, you guys know it's when I started at the harbor, it was looked at as we were boat guys. It was, you know, the RWC program was pretty new. The thought of being in the surf lineup to a lot of these guys scared them. And you guys know when you get somebody that comes through that's a surfer, that's been in the water their whole life, you know, I mean, I've been body surfing. I grew up on the East Coast, you know, body surfing hurricanes and, you know, trying to be in the water when it was big. And, you know, and it's kind of led me to this focal point of my career. And I get to use all that stuff that I did as a kid and, you know, and staying fit and knowing that, you know, what the ocean throws at me, you know, I need to be able to get out of, you know, on my own or get my team out as well, you know, and it's just, you know, it's paramount, you know, keep yourself in shape, you know, run extra when you're tired, go run. 'Cause your day is coming, you know, everybody that's listening here, you know, if you're new and, you know, you hear all the old stories, but you know, after 15, 20 years, we're all going to have our own, and you guys have them sitting there right there with the two of you. I know you guys have got some awesome stories and, you know, they come, you know.
Yeah, man. And I think, you know, Bill's talking about your past training and stuff. There's a lot to just personal fitness and what you did to do a cartwheel off a jet ski.
Absolutely.
On the face of a wave and, yeah, you know, bear hug this lady. So, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, that's not just training. That's recognizing the situation for what it is, being confident enough in yourself and your physical condition to get in there and do it. And you did it, man. And, dude, crazy respect for you,
yeah,
for that story.
Yeah, what an awesome story, man, for,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, I really just got to thank my team, you know, the team of guys we have, the incident command says, I've already touched on it, and I don't need to again, but it really was a team effort, you know. Yeah. I made the grab. I happened to be there. I'd like to think that any of the guys that I train with, any of the guys at the harbor, had they been given that exact same situation, I would like to think that they would do the same thing. You know, we really do take it seriously, and it's our job, you know, and we're so stoked to have the Coast Guard and Sector San Francisco. You guys are always backing us up, and we can't say enough good things about you. And you touched on that, race into the calls. We definitely want to be there. We want to be there first.
Oh yeah, man. I know.
You know, and it's good, healthy competition. I mean, we train a lot.
I should say that, right? It's good, healthy competition. Right. Like we know that Pillar Point's got it. And you know, you guys know you got it. You know, we have something north of you. And like you said, it's a team effort, man. If you guys ever needed a backup, somebody was going to be there, right? Like,
yeah,
no matter where they're from. And I have every confidence in the world, man, that anybody at Pillar Point Harbor Master or anyone involved in that IC would have done exactly like you said. They would have jumped in there and tried to make a difference, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why we do it.
Well,
all right.
Dude, awesome. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for sharing your story, man. I tell you what, I want to have you back on one day, and we want to talk about, like, just jet ski operation out there, because what you guys do is very unique, and the environment that you get to do it in is very unique. So, you know, I'll throw that out to you. If you ever want to come back, Jacob, if you get another save, or you want to come back on, or you know some other good talker out there, just let us know, man. Point us to him. Love,
yeah,
to hear him.
For sure. And I definitely, I've got stories for days. I've got, you know, I've got a lot of stories. We won't put it on this one, but
sure.
I got Officer of the Year in 2010 for a save I did up north of Mavericks, and that's the next episode.
There we go.
hey, dude, I know that you're involved in a kind of a nonprofit thing down there. What is it?
Yeah, so thanks for giving me the platform here. I really appreciate talking to you guys today. But one of the things that I'm kind of spearheading with the Harbor is we put together a team. I'll give a shout out to Monster and Sea. So Monster and Sea is an organization that every year for the last 6 years, watermen around the globe have put together teams of six to paddle in a relay format 24 hours of one day. And their whole goal is to raise community grassroots money for local families that are battling cancer. It's a great organization. I first was made aware of them. I was doing a paddle across the Monterey Bay, a prone paddle where you lay on your stomach, not a stand-up. I'm not a stand-up paddleboarder. So we use just our arms. But I paddled across the Monterey Bay for cystic fibrosis with a team of 16 other people, unassisted. It's about 28 nautical miles. And I was made aware of Monster and Sea, and we kind of got that paddle behind us, and we all successfully completed it. And then we started talking about Monster and Sea, and about the same time we started talking about it and kind of their mission statement, and like, hey, that'd be kind of cool to get a group of patrolmen. Like, let's just do this with just a patrolman. Let's put a team together and sponsor one of these local kids that's battling leukemia in our community and, you know, make a difference. You know, this is something we can do. We're watermen. You know, you're paddling relay format. So, you know, max 5 to 6 hours in the water, depending on how it comes through the night, you know, and it's supposed to be tough. It's supposed to be cold. The goal with the 24 and paddling in the ocean at night is, you know, you're not paddling for distance. You're paddling to be out there. You want whoever you end up picking as you're going to sponsor them, you want them, you know, it's basically the battle. It signifies the battle that they deal with every day with cancer. You know, every day is the same for these people. They wake up and they're still battling cancer. And, you know, it's touches close to home with me. I've got a good friend who's dealing with some throat cancer right now. And he's a good dude. He's given his whole life serving. Give me one second, guys.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. All right. No, you're good. Yeah, Wyatt Winworth, he's a longtime friend. He served in the Navy. He was a USCG reservist for years. He's a firefighter. He's currently working as a rescue swimmer for Brevard County Sheriff's Air Asset Unit. Came down with throat cancer. Great dude. He was awarded the Guinness World Record in 2007 on the entire coast of Florida on his stomach.
Wow.
In 10 days, just to raise awareness about ocean safety and ocean beach drownings. And he subsequently was able to get those basically like Jim Buoy style what the lifeguards use, the Jim Buoy buoys.
The cans, yeah.
Yeah, on every beach in Florida. Because wow. You know, and just a good dude, you know, and he's got a young daughter and he came down with throat cancer and it's bad. It's you know, and so I told my team of guys, like, we had already decided to pick a young boy, Hernan Lopez, who's a local kid in our community who's battling childhood leukemia, super strong kid. And I said, hey, would you guys be willing to do both? You know, can we sponsor both? And they said, yeah. And so we started a Facebook page. It's called The 24. So the and then numbers 24 Half Moon Bay. You'll find us on there. And it's a great thing. And if any of your listeners want to sponsor, give, you know, $2, $5. We'd be so stoked to have your support. And if not, just get on the 24 page and leave this guy a note. You know, today on the 20th, he's finishing his last round of chemo, which has been so insane for him. He's refused to take the feeding tube, and he's just a fighter. This guy has given his whole life saving others. And, you know, if you just get on there and leave him a message, you know, if that's all you can do, you know, he would be so stoked. And it'd mean a lot to all of us, you know.
So, sure, man. The 24 Half Moon Bay, right?
Yeah, the 24 Half Moon Bay. Monster and C are the guys. If you want to find them on Instagram, it's at Monster and C. And if you guys ever want to hit me up at Jake, J-A-C, and then Walding, my last name, on Instagram. I love having guys in my friend group that are similar, like-minded people like your followers, you know.
Solid, man.
Hey, yeah, the Monster and C.
We'll start the giving to Monster and C, dude. The podcast will pledge a hundo.
Absolutely.
I wish you guys all the best of luck, dude, and raise as much as you can. So everybody give out to these guys. It's important.
Yeah, thanks a bunch, guys. Their slogan is "Go because you can," and
solid.
You know, that means it's a solid lot. To slogan. People, yeah. You know? It's a solid slogan, and you know we're healthy. And I would love to, you know, I'll help any of your listeners out there that want to do something similar. It's great. It's an awesome team building experience. My kid had heard me talking about it with my wife and kind of the dynamic, and they're putting together the first kids team. So they've got
raising them well. Brother.
That's awesome, man.
Them well.
Yeah, that's they've awesome, got yeah. 9 to 14 year olds, and they're going to paddle through the night. So all of your listeners can do this. This is not something that's unachievable, and it makes a real difference in your local community. And you know, just the fact that you're out there thugging it out and paddling and getting after it every day, training to get ready for it. You know, it just gives you a little taste of what it's like, and cancer touches so many people, and it's relentless. It's a relentless killer that never stops. And you know, go because you can. Don't stop. You know, keep going forward.
Sure,
I love it, Jacob. Thanks for the message, man. Thanks for what you do down in Pillar Point. Thanks for keeping those guys on their toes down there, because I know you are, and for your efforts with Monster and C. But we really appreciate your time today, man.
Yeah, thanks for your time very much, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. And thanks to you guys, too, man, for what you do. You guys have lived a life in the armed forces, and I come from a long line of that in my past. And I'm thankful for every one of you guys that's enlisted to serve your country. And it's an honor working with you guys, you know, Sector San Francisco and everybody that's out there in the world keeping us safe here at home, man. We all appreciate it.
Solid, bro. Hey, any party shots?
Nah, man. All right, man. I'm good. Hey, I talk too much. I don't like to talk that much.
Stay safe out there, dude, and definitely stay healthy, all right, in these times. Thanks for giving everybody something positive to listen to.
For sure. Take care of yourself, Jake.
All right, thanks, guys. Man. You too.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooutcom or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.